NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, Todd.
Oh, hello, John.
It's just you and I tonight, and we're going to talk about a recent event. I know you're right there in sunny California enjoying yourself.
There is sunny California here above the clouds today.
Oh, putting in some time, huh?
Yep.
All right, so I'm sitting down in Florida, and I was putting some time around the boat show. The biggest in-the-water boat show is here in Miami, watching a lot of the things that I can't possibly buy. But we had an unfortunate event while I was down here this week, and that we had a Challenger 604 try to make a dead stick landing on a highway with a lot of complications, and we'll get into it in a moment. And unfortunately, the pilot and the co-pilot perished. But fortunately, the flight attendant and two passengers were able to get out of the airplane. So we'll talk about the details. It's not much known at this point in time, but there's also a very limited amount of possible causation here. So we'll talk about what we know and where the investigation could possibly go. So I'll let you introduce the accident.
Certainly. This accident happened on February 9, 2024, literally 5 days before we're speaking now. And there's not much in the way of official information from the FAA or the NTSB about this. But between news reports and other sources, it would appear that this aircraft had a fairly normal flight from Ohio, heading south toward Naples, Florida. The final half hour or so of the flight was just off the west coast of Florida over the Gulf of Mexico. And it turned inbound toward Naples. And again, nothing out of the ordinary, no weather issues going on. They had, I believe, scattered clouds at 5,000 feet, fairly light winds, a regular day. And for reasons as yet unknown, the flight crew called in shortly before they crashed, saying that they had lost engines and they needed to make an emergency landing. And they were at such a low altitude, even though they were 3 miles away from the airport, they couldn't make it to the airport. And as you can see from a graphic that we're going to show you from AOPO, they have the flight path of the aircraft as it makes a right turn going toward, it appears, landing on Interstate 75, which is a fairly wide and very straight road in that part of Florida. And as you can see from a still that we're going to show in the video version of this, which was taken from a dash cam of a truck behind where this aircraft crashed, you can see that there was moderate traffic on the road. And the airplane, from the video clip that we're going to have, has attempted successfully, actually, landed on the run on the highway itself. They came in at an angle with some momentum when they touched down. And although they put the aircraft down on the roadway, it went over to the right off the roadway. The right wing hit a large wall that was next to the highway. And that's when the aircraft broke up and caught fire.
You know, in one of the early reports, they actually had his left wing hit a car or a truck with an individual in it, but he was okay. I don't know if he had any injuries, but he was said to be okay by the local press down here. So that was good news on that point. You know, it's not uncommon for airplanes to land on highways. I was out in the Keys a few years ago, and I'm coming northbound on the road. And as I passed by the airport, I saw a small general aviation airplane getting ready to take off. And I wasn't maybe a mile or two up the road. I don't know how far up the road I was, but it gets into some open terrain. And there's a bicycle path that's to the, on, because I was heading north, that was on my left. And here comes that little airplane, very quiet, and had an engine failure, I found out after. But very quiet, just landed on the bicycle path. Did some damage to the wings because there were trees. But the airplane stayed intact, and they walked away from it. So, and then we also had an airliner crash with not so lucky. But we actually had a Southern Airways DC-9 that encountered severe weather, hail, rain, and had a dual-engine flame out. And that flight crew put it down on the highway as well, although they hit the wings, hit some poles. We had a real accident out of that, and we had some fatalities. I forget how many now. We can pull that report up and put it in this version, our podcast, our YouTube channel. So we can put that in there too, just to satisfy anybody's curiosity.
And you mentioned that Southern Airways event. It has parallels to this one in that you have an aircraft, a jet aircraft, not a small one, that had a problem, had to make an emergency landing, did not have an option, and they're able to put the airplane on the ground and have some people survive. So it's a testament to the skill of the pilots just to get the airplane, in the case of Southern Airways, on a small road in a country town, and in this case, on a major interstate highway. But in both cases, you had obstructions on either side of the road that they couldn't avoid, and you had a post-crash fire. And although we're not going to show too many pictures of it, there are many, many reports over the years of people illegally smuggling drugs and whatnot into various places in the Caribbean and the United States, where they can land aircraft on dirt roads, on roads with trees on both sides. So again, with some level of skill, and I can't vouch for how much skill drug runners have, but the ones who survived, there have been many, many cases where they were able to put it on small roads, big roads, dirt roads, all over the United States and the Caribbean.
Well, you know, years ago, I think I said I was in Florida. Down here, I remember that it was a very common occurrence for drug runners to land their airplanes on Route 27, which is in the middle of the states, essentially. Long straight road, clean from just north of Miami all the way up to the lake in Clewiston. And I mean, it's 30 miles at least of long straight road in there. And they were always talking about finding drug airplanes that had crashed landing on those roads or were disturbed by intruders, meaning the police or other people, and they abandoned the airplane and got out of there. And sometimes they'd find money, sometimes they'd find drugs in or near the airplane. So it's not uncommon to land airplanes on roadways, especially today. Our roadways are pretty big because of the truck traffic. So it's not uncommon to have a three-lane highway. Well, three lanes is 30, 40 feet. You can land a pretty good size airplane on that.
As you can see from some of the stills we have here of this particular event, this was a three-lane interstate with a shoulder on both sides. So given the size of this airplane, which is about 64 feet, about 20 meters wingspan, and the landing gear would be considerably more narrow than that. If they had perfect conditions, they could have, in my opinion, given how long and straight this road was, could have easily landed this airplane on this highway.
Oh, I believe they could as well. After they got it down, after they hit that one motor vehicle and that person was all right, and went off and hit that wall, which is really a sound barrier for all the people that have their houses right up against the highway. I mean, we're putting them up all over the country to deflect the sound, to give people some peace and quiet, because the roads never stop. And those are pretty substantial. As fences, they're very substantial. And so the crew hit it, and we don't have any information yet on what was the cause of death for the flight crew, but it's obviously going to be one of two things. It was either blunt force trauma, or it's going to be smoke or fire. So, but fortunately, the other three didn't get out. But how are we here? You know, what's the NTSB going to be doing now? They've picked up the airplane. They've removed it from the area that it is, that the accident happened after they conducted their initial investigation, which means documenting the crash site. And they moved that. A local paper said they moved it to, I believe it was Jacksonville, but they moved it to someplace secure so that they can piece through it at a later date. Fortunately, from the pictures I saw, that the engines appeared to remain intact. So if they are in fact intact, and the view is from the rear of the airplane, if there is no damage from birds, ingestion, or any kind of other damage to the engines, it would leave it then to mechanical causes. And there's not too many yet after flying for, you know, essentially a 6-hour day, have a mechanical failure at that point in flight. So it would be unusual, but they will be looking for mechanical failures. You know, what could affect two engines? Well, fuel is the most obvious example. And running out of fuel was the first thing that I heard a lot of pilots saying. But when I look at the pictures and see the size of that initial fireball, I don't believe that they were out of fuel. Now, they could have mismanaged their fuel, and they could have had fuel in one tank and not in the other tank and not realized they were burning. Both engines were running off one tank. That's a distinct possibility. This was a very experienced professional flight crew. So I would tend to, that has to be pursued, but I wouldn't jump at that right off the bat. But there's got to be some other process that's common to both engines that escapes initial review. Now, there's a couple of mistakes the crew could have made that led to this kind of event, but that would be even bigger speculation than the fuel issue. So we'll just leave that on the table until we get some more information from the NTSB or other sources.
And so far, there's no official word from the NTSB as to what sort of information was on board the airplane. Did they have a cockpit voice recorder? Did they have a flight data recorder? What we do know is that there are air traffic control communications, which are, of course, open to the public. And some websites like liveatc.net have clips of those conversations. And the one thing that struck me was that after the engine failure and they called to the airport, the pilot who was speaking was in a calm, even tone of voice. No sign of panic, no sign of loss of control of his ability to fly the airplane. And he was very calmly communicating, short communication, but calmly communicating with the ground. And shortly after that, of course, the aircraft hit the ground. And it remains to be seen if there's any useful information from either recordings on board the airplane or from the survivors. There are two passengers and a flight attendant who were in the back who all escaped and were all alive. So that'll be another source of information, as well as looking into the operation of this Part 135 carrier. Was there anything wrong with the issues with the airplane with respect to deferred maintenance? Were there fueling issues at any point? Those kinds of questions. But again, very early in the investigation, no official word yet. So speculation is not something we're going to do at this point.
You know, losing two engines in a jet airplane 400 or 500 feet above the ground, it's quite unusual. Quite unusual. So it's gonna take an unusual set of circumstances that led up to it. So I trust that the NTSB will be digging a little deeper on this one than they normally have, given how many of these Bombardier airplanes are flying. Basically, the 600 to the 605 are the same airframe and very similar systems in all those different models. So there's quite a few of them out there. So that it's going to be quite a bit of interest to get to the bottom of how we could have lost two engines on an airplane like
and
this.
They're well over 1,000. I'm not sure the exact numbers, but well over 1,000 that have been produced during the lifespan of this aircraft. They're flown by civilian and military operators all over the world, corporate operators, Part 135 operators, what have you. And variants of this, expanded variants of this, have been used as small airliners as well. So should there be anything inherent to the design of the aircraft or of the systems, it could be something that would affect a number of planes around the world. But again, very, very preliminary part of the investigation. It might be weeks or months before anything substantial comes of it.
Yes, I'm sure if there was something obvious with the engines, like a bird strike, that would have already been announced. So it's going to be something that's going to take a little more work to uncover. But we will keep everyone posted as we find the facts coming out. We'll update this podcast with any new material that we get our hands on. All right, with that, Todd, I'll let you give the second last word.
Well, this is something that comes up frequently in the shows that we do. What do you do in an emergency? How do you plan for it? Well, one way to plan for it is to keep in mind at critical phases of flight, what's my plan of what to do if something goes wrong? Every time I take off, I assess the airport I'm at. I assess the obstacles that might be out there. I say to myself, okay, if there's a problem, I'll go in this direction or that direction, or I'll fly over in this direction where there's mud flats where I can land in an emergency, as opposed to trying making it back to the airport. Not that I'm thinking it's going to happen every time, but putting oneself in that state of mind will put you in a place where, should something happen, even something nowhere near as catastrophic as what happened to this aircraft, rather than obsessing on what do I do next, you've already thought it through 100 times. You'll just do it.
Yes, we've seen that over and over. People trying to save the airplane by returning to the airport and getting into the impossible turn. We talk about that often on this program. It takes a very, very experienced and practiced pilot to be able to make that turn after takeoff with the likes of an engine failure. And you're far better off, have far higher chances of surviving if you just find a place in front of you and put the airplane down, rather than trying to get back to the airport. You know, airplanes can be replaced, the person can't be. So, and as always, I would say to you, please, if you're gonna go flying, do what Todd just said, a good job of pre-planning. All right, plan for the unexpected. When you get out to the airport, plan it again. When you get to your airplane, do a thorough pre-flight. We still have problems virtually. Every time I go digging into the records to try to find another podcast material for a podcast, I come across another accident or another incident where maybe somebody didn't die, but where the airplane was substantially damaged, and it was a result of poor pre-flights. You know, gust locks installed. We still have people taken off with gust locks installed in the airplane. And we still have bad fuel in airplanes. What happened to the sumping? You know, sometimes in watching people sump airplanes, I think they're just putting fuel in the glass and throwing it away. I don't think they even know what they're looking for. So, I mean, please, please do a good pre-flight. And when you get in the air, put that head on a swivel, because the number of reported close calls is just too high, too high. So you are our brother's keeper. It's not just us flying our little envelope, think we're safe. You got to put your head on a swivel and protect the other guy as well, because it's your butt and it's going to be the other guy's butt too. So please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.